Welcome. This is Zero Point Radio Hour on VBS. This is Jim Moffitt sitting in for Christopher Holmes, Dr. Christopher Holmes this week. I have a message for Dr. Christopher Holmes. If you're out there and you're listening on VBS, could you please call us to make a connection at 530-876-3222. We're having trouble establishing connection with Dr. Holmes, who is currently in New Zealand, continuing his lecture tour to various theosophical lodges in New Zealand and expounding on his articulation of the secret doctrine and how it relates to contemporary physics and the psychology of consciousness and the model that he's developed. Those of you who are familiar with the show, who have listened before, will know that Dr. Holmes usually starts out with a brief overview of his teaching and talks about the zero-point teaching, which is what he calls the model of consciousness that he's derived from mystical and esoteric studies. I should direct you to Christopher's website, which is at www.zeropoint, all one word, .ca. And if you go there, you'll find that he has a variety of his writings and commentaries on numerous issues pertaining to the psychology of consciousness and how that pertains to spirituality as well as modern science, and as well as various political commentaries and references to other websites. And I'd urge you to check it out. Christopher's published several books on the subject of consciousness as derived from a mystical esoteric perspective. He's a clinical psychologist who has studied these a wide variety of esoteric and mystical teachings for 30 years and has attempted to take that knowledge and develop it in an integrative perspective with both modern psychology and especially modern physics. He addresses various issues in science, but his specialty is in physics and cosmology, as well as his background in psychology. And he articulates a unique integration of the ancient and the ancient wisdom and modern knowledge to develop a very, I think, a really an unparalleled model of consciousness in which he explores a variety of issues and really which addresses virtually everything, all and everything, as G.I. Gurdjieff would say. I'm not exactly what I'm going to talk about here today because, as I say, I was expecting Christopher to be with me, and unfortunately, I can only be on for an hour today, so hopefully we're going to make some sort of connection here, or we're going to have an abbreviated show. But just to kind of touch on a couple of things, as I say, over the last, I guess we've been on BBS now for about a year and a half. I believe we started in April of 2006. And in each program, Christo, as I say, begins with an overview of his work and talks about the zero-point teaching and some aspect of how he understands consciousness and from a variety of different perspectives than that which most people who speak about consciousness in modern thought, he deals with in quite different ways. One of the things that that he does stress is what he calls the heart doctrine, which he has derived from a variety of teachings, and this is contrasted with what he calls the head doctrine, which is his characterization of modern psychological and philosophical perspectives on consciousness. Almost everyone who speaks about consciousness in modern studies, and it's a huge area now, consciousness is studied from a variety of scientific perspectives, makes a basic ontological and epistemological assumption, an assumption about the nature of knowledge and being, or being and knowledge, I should say, in which they just assume that consciousness is produced by the activities of the brain, the head brain, the neurochemical processes of the neurons. Now, as much as that's a very reasonable perspective and is widely assumed, it is an assumption. Nobody actually knows how this happens. This is one of the great mysteries that confronts, I would say, perhaps the greatest mystery that confronts modern science and psychology is what is the nature of consciousness? How does consciousness originate? How exactly is the mind produced by the brain. Now, there are a variety of perspectives on this, but almost everyone assumes that the brain produces consciousness. By contrast, if you begin to study the a variety of ancient teachings, you'll find a very consistent representation of the idea that consciousness doesn't actually originate in the brain, but rather originates in the heart. And it's very kind of complicated explanation of how this happens, but it basically involves the idea that consciousness is a property of the absolute, and it is stepped down through a series of gradations, through a series of dimensions, and enters the human being through a minute point in the heart. And this is actually in the metaphysical heart, but manifests in the actual physical heart. And so the idea is that consciousness is a light within which illuminates the psychic functions of the brain. So you absolutely have to have a brain to be conscious, but the consciousness does not originate in the brain from this perspective. Rather, the illumination comes from the dimensionless point that exists in the heart, and that this is the light source which illuminates the psychic functions in the brain. Now, this is a fundamentally different perspective from that which is assumed in modern thought, and that's why Dr. Holmes labels this the heart doctrine. Now, what's really interesting about this is that about 20 years ago, after Chris had studied mystical teachings and esoteric teachings for a long time, he began to become more and more interested in this idea that somehow consciousness was not just something that was produced by the brain and wasn't just another name for the psychic functions of the brain, but was actually something. And as he studied more and more mystical teachings, he began to be really astounded by the fact that he discovered that repeatedly within these teachings, they speak of consciousness and the self as arising in the heart. And the idea is that in the Vedas and in various Hindu teachings and ancient Buddhist teachings, there's this idea that there's a spiritual spark. And it's in Sufism also, but there's a spiritual spark which arises in the heart, and that this is the self in the Jiva Atma in the Hindu teachings, which is related to the over-self or to the greater self, to spirit. And it's an infinitesimally small point which is located in the heart and which is actually somehow resonant with the greater self, with spirit. So the idea is that by knowing yourself in your heart, like to truly know yourself and to be truly present in this spiritual spark in the heart, you can be one with the cosmos, you can be one with God. Now, that's a very, very fundamentally, dramatically different perspective, but from that which modern thought puts forth about the nature of consciousness. And what's really astounding is that as Chris worked at this for several years, is that he started to write a book which he called The Heart Doctrine, in which he contrasted the heart doctrine with modern head doctrine. And at one point, I was helping him by editing his manuscripts, and I said to him one point, as I read these further and further refinements of his manuscript, and he'd always be adding new material, I said to him, you know, it's really amazing. It's almost like you have too many examples of this from too many teachings, because it's consistent throughout these teachings, this idea that the heart is where consciousness arises. And yet, it's there, and yet even people who are sympathetic or who incorporate mystical and esoteric teachings into their perspectives all seem to, I don't know of anybody who really, other than the heart master Adida, who is a contemporary teacher, almost everybody still talks as if the brain is the source of consciousness. Now again, maybe it is, but there's an overwhelming body of evidence which suggests that it isn't, from these numerous mystical and esoteric perspectives in which people have studied themselves systematically, and they found that the self is not in the brain, and it's not in any other part of the body, but it's actually centered in this point in the heart. And at this point in the heart is, in essence, is a gateway to the higher dimensions of one's being and to the higher dimensions of the cosmos, so that you can exist in these higher dimensional being bodies, and at the same time, when you exist in these higher dimensional being bodies, you exist in higher dimensions of the cosmos. Now, again, as I say, this is such a such a radically different idea from that which most people assume, and which the framework in which most people consider the nature of consciousness, that it takes some considerable thought and contemplation and self-observation and self-study in order to begin to understand, first of all, that this is a real possibility, and that secondly, that by incorporating this perspective, you can come to a very different understanding about a lot of phenomena which are not really explicable in terms of modern psychological thought. Now, I would actually go further than that and say that really nothing regarding consciousness is explicable in terms of modern psychological thought, because everyone assumes that consciousness is produced in the brain. And again, like, you'll see over and over again, you'll find a variety of references where people will very boldly make statements. Like, for instance, in Carl Sagan's book, Cosmos, published in, I think, 1980, which was the book which accompanied his highly acclaimed television series, he says very boldly that the cerebral cortex is the site where consciousness manifests out of the material processes of the brain, something to that effect. Well, there's absolutely, much as that is a reasonable assumption, there's absolutely no evidence to suggest that that's true. Stanislav Grof, who's known for his work with holotropic breathing as a psychiatrist who's explored mystical and esoteric teachings, says that this is really the most radical epistemological assumption about how we know in Western science and Western thought, and he's exactly right. And so people have no compunction about making these statements for which there really is no evidence. I mean, it's funny because Carl Sagan's reputation was as this hard-nosed skeptic who questioned all postulates and theories which weren't substantiated by fact, and yet he makes the most radical assertion about the nature of being without any real evidence. He says at one point that there's, in one of his books of the Dragons of Eden, that there's not an iota or shred of evidence to suggest the idea of a soul or of a psyche which exists apart from the material processes of the brain. And yet at the same time, there's not an iota or a shred of evidence to suggest that consciousness is produced by the brain, as he says. Another example, John Searle, philosopher, who specializes in consciousness and who's renowned as an expert, said in a book which was published a couple of years ago, Conversations on Consciousness by Susan Blackmore, a British psychologist. She interviewed most of the leading consciousness researchers, quote-unquote, in the world. I would say most of the conventional leading consciousness researchers in the world. And John Searle, at one point, he's talking with her and says, well, the one thing we know is that all experience is produced by the brain. Every damn one of them is produced by the brain. Well, first of all, just because you get mad and say every damn one of them, it's like sort of like kicking an appliance. It doesn't actually make it work any better. And saying that every damn one of them is produced by the brain doesn't make it true. And yet, Searle is very, very adamant that the brain produces consciousness and experience. Again, where is the proof for this? I would say that at the very least, one of the really fascinating aspects of Christopher Holmes's work is that it calls into question these basic assumptions. Now, maybe he's wrong. I don't think he is, but perhaps at the very least, this provides a basis for reconsidering these fundamental questions. And as I say, if it was just his work and it was just his ideas, I would be much more, I would be much less confident about the reality of what he's saying, but I'm quite convinced of the reality of what he's saying, because this is based on various mystics and seers and sages of thousands and thousands of years of human history from a variety of different perspectives who all come to the same conclusion, that consciousness arises in the heart. Now, and these are people who have studied themselves systematically, whereas By contrast, modern psychologists and modern philosophers don't really study themselves systematically. They think about things and they generate ideas, but they don't study themselves systematically. And this is why I would say that the ancient esoteric and mystical teachings are much more scientific in terms of studying consciousness than are the conventional modern psychological and philosophical perspectives. So as I say, at the very least, this is a really fascinating way to question our assumptions about what we know about consciousness, and Christopher's articulation of what he calls the heart doctrine is at the very least a very useful and very provocative perspective to try to understand the nature of the self, the nature of consciousness, how it's possible that we might have a soul and that we are spiritual beings and that we might know ourselves, the universe, and the gods. And that last statement is it refers to the aphorism that was engraved over the Temple of Apollo at Delphi, which was, "Man, know thyself, and thou wilt know the universe and the gods." And this is the origin of the idea, know thyself. It's usually ascribed to Socrates, but as Gurdjieff says, G.I. Gurdjieff says, this is a very, very ancient idea, one which is pre-Socratic, and one which is much more complicated than that which most people understand, even people of a philosophical or psychological bent who have interest in these things, than it's generally supposed. Most people don't really understand, when you say know thyself, what that really entails. And knowing thyself is not a superficial process of knowing our likes and our dislikes, the various aspects of our personalities, our proclivities, our tendencies, our attributes, is to know the real self, the self which is obscured by our lower level of normal consciousness. I'm going to take a little break here. I'm trying to I'm just making this up as I go along, so bear with me. But what I'm trying to get to is the idea is that really, to self-knowledge in the esoteric and mystical tradition leads to a perspective and a study of oneself which has to be systematic. You can't just study yourself according to any old set of ideas. You have to have a system, and to do that throughout human history, there have been various schools, esoteric schools, which have produced different methods for studying oneself systematically. And what these schools have in common is that they reveal that the normal waking state of consciousness is not at all what we understand it to be, and that the normal understanding of the self is not what we understand it to be, that we are multidimensional beings in reality, and that we have connections, possible connections, to higher dimensional realities. Now, within each of us, these are latent or dormant properties of consciousness and being, and in order to understand these latent or dormant faculties of consciousness and being, we have to work to overcome the sources of sleep and normal waking consciousness, and the sources of illusion and distortion which lead us to misunderstand the nature of self and the nature of consciousness. So each of these esoteric methods are premised on the idea that we can awaken consciousness, we can know the self, but that to do so is the result of long and very difficult and very arduous work, and requires discipline, it requires a teacher, it requires systematic self-study. Now, you would never know if you read the critics of mysticism, the so-called skeptics, the rational skeptics who dismiss mysticism and the idea of esotericism, although most rational skeptics don't even know what esotericism is, and they certainly don't understand what mysticism is in reality. They have some sort of wildly distorted idea of what mysticism is, that it somehow refers to vague or insubstantial or misty ideas about the nature of the self and the cosmos and one's relation to the cosmos, when in fact mystical teachings really provide a very rigorous, lucid, and coherent explanation of how the self is related to the cosmos and how it's possible to know oneself. So we're back to this idea that know thyself and thou wilt know the universe and the gods. Now, if people were to discuss that, most people were to discuss that, most contemporary thinkers, they would say that this is some sort of a poetic or metaphorical allusion to self-knowledge. But I would say, no, it's not that at all. It's a literal description prescribing a method to know higher reality, to know the higher reality of oneself, to know the higher realities of the cosmos, and to know how the higher realities of the self and the cosmos are connected. Now, again, as I say, within modern thought, this is an absurdity because no one really takes seriously the idea that we have a higher self, and nobody really takes seriously the fact that it is possible to know oneself and to know God, in the universe. And yet there are numerous descriptions of higher states of cosmic consciousness in which people have, through disciplined efforts, realized these incredible states of consciousness in which they are one with the universe. One of the examples that Christopher and I have talked about several times on this program is that of Yogananda, who Paramahansa Yogananda, who created the Self-Realization Foundation and brought yogic teachings to the West in I believe the 1930s, settled in California. In his wonderful book, The Autobiography of a Yogi, Yogananda describes his experience of cosmic consciousness. He had developed to a certain extent through his yogic studies with his master, and yet he was frustrated because he'd never experienced samadhi. And at one point he sort of ruefully complained to his master that he didn't seem to be experiencing what he hoped to experience, and his master reached over and thumped him on the chest just above the heart. And as a result of that, Yogananda started to experience his consciousness expanding so that he was simultaneously aware of an increasing volume of space. He was aware of everything around the ashram. He was aware of the whole town, the whole area in which he was physically located. And at the same time, his consciousness was penetrating everything so that he could actually see the sap in trees moving, and he could see the insides of plants, and he could see the insides of everything. And he explains as he goes into higher and higher states of consciousness and that eventually he gets to the point where he sees galaxies being formed and collapsing, and he sees the entirety of creation kind of unfolding and dissolving, and it's an extraordinary description. What he's describing, though, is how at one point he says he cognized he cognized that a minute point within his heart was the center of everything, and that his experience was centered in this minute point in his heart, but yet it was simultaneously pervading all of creation. So what he was in essence saying was that by knowing himself, having this direct apprehension of the nature of himself in his heart, he was at the same time aware of the entire cosmos. And he says at one point he realized that he talks about this incredible light that he experienced, which is the most common feature of all higher states of consciousness, is that people describe this incredible, ineffable, supernal light, which is light which is beyond light as we know it. And he says that he realized that material reality was composed of tissues of light, and that this was God's body. And so everything in material creation was, in fact, God's body composed of these tissues of light. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary description. And Chris and I have been talking about this for 25 years now and trying to understand leading ourselves to newer and newer understanding of what Yogananda is describing by integrating it with other aspects of mystical and esoteric teachings about consciousness. But if you take Yogananda's experience in which he directly apprehends himself as this intuitive point of perception in his heart, I think that's actually the phrase that I was struggling to remember earlier, then you come to a radically different understanding of the nature of consciousness. He didn't realize that he was an intuitive point of perception in his cerebral cortex. He realized that it was in his heart, and that there was a light source in his heart which was somehow tied to the light of creation. And now this has staggering implications in terms of what he's describing is, in terms of modern physics, he's experiencing non-locality. He's experiencing everything simultaneously, and so he's not in any one place or in any one time. Time and space have been collapsed somehow because his body is one with the cosmic structure. Now, much as psychologists know a lot of things about psychology of human beings, a lot of it has to do with watching rats run, murdering them, and duping undergraduates, but not too many of them actually have ever had an experience of cosmic consciousness. So I would say that at the very least, that the most open-minded perspective on this psychology of consciousness being described by Yogananda, as well as numerous other masters and sages throughout the ages, is to try to understand these people, what they're saying about the nature of consciousness, to try to understand it in their terms, not to try to reduce it to our very incomplete and really restricted understanding of the nature of consciousness, not to assume that somehow that these experiences they're describing are the result of some sort of rogue molecules in the brain. No, they're describing something that they not only experience directly, but something that they strove to develop, and something which is an experience which has been repeated by many people throughout the ages. So I would say the most open-minded perspective on this is to try to understand these experiences in the terms that these people are describing it. And that leads us back to the idea of the heart doctrine. Because repeatedly, as I said, in all sorts of traditions, there's this description of this minute divine spark within the heart, which somehow is our connection to God and to the cosmos. And we have to try to understand how this is possible if we're going to develop an alternative model of consciousness and being. And then that's, in essence, what Dr. Christopher Holmes has been doing for the last 30 years in trying to understand how it's possible to know oneself, the universe, and the gods. Now, Chris, if you were out there, it would be really nice if you would call the program. As I said, I wasn't really prepared for this today, so if you can call us on the direct line, that would be really good. One of the things that, just to get back to this, to provide another angle on this, is that 30 years ago, Christopher Holmes was studying to get his PhD in clinical psychology at the University of Waterloo in Waterloo, Ontario. And he was going along, and he was a very good student and had a very promising career ahead of him, but he had an interest in the self, and he also had an interest in parapsychology. And these weren't like his primary interest, but because of that, he read, somebody recommended to him that he read P.D. Uspensky's book In Search of the Miraculous, because it dealt with the nature of self and self-consciousness, and it also had material related to the paranormal. So he read that, and that book is an account of Uspensky's meeting G.I. Gurdjieff, the very enigmatic master and mystic in pre-revolutionary Russia. I believe it starts in 1912 and 1914 and runs to about 1919, 1920, and it describes Uspensky's experience with Gurdjieff and his study of Gurdjieff's teaching, which is called The Fourth Way. And it's an extraordinary book, and I think in my experience, I've never read any book which is quite as profound to me as In Search of the Miraculous. It's an amazing book. I've read it several times, and there isn't anything in it that doesn't call into question your understanding of everything. It's just a revolutionary, radical reconceptualization of the nature of our being and our consciousness and being and the nature of the cosmos. And so as a result of that, that's how Chris and I both began to get into studying mystical and esoteric teachings. At the same time as he was doing his PhD, I was doing my master's in social psychology and at Carleton University in Ottawa, where Chris and I had been undergraduates together. And so very quickly after reading Uspensky, Christopher began, he was just beginning to work on his doctoral dissertation, and he decided that he was going to incorporate these ideas from Gurdjieff's teaching to try to develop a model of consciousness. And what he did was he surveyed modern ideas of consciousness. Now, at the time, like this is 1976, I think is when he actually began studying Gurdjieff. Consciousness was just sort of beginning to come back into psychology. For many years, consciousness had been actively excluded by psychologists from the study of psychology. And it was through the work of various transpersonal psychologists such as Charles Tart and Robert Ornstein that academic psychology had begun to reintroduce consciousness into psychology. And then shortly after that, more and more psychologists began to study consciousness in terms of neuropsychology and study the brain. But at the time, it was really quite a radical decision for a psychologist, especially for a PhD student, to even begin to study the psychology of consciousness. So Chris worked at articulating and extrapolating from Gurdjieff and articulating his ideas about the nature of consciousness, the most basic of which is the idea that our normal waking consciousness is not really a waking state, but is a state of what he calls waking sleep, or a state of associative kind of hypnotic, semi-hypnotic sleep. Gurdjieff says that we suffer from several psychological illusions, that we are awake, that we are unified beings, that we are self-conscious, and that we do. He says that rather than doing, everything happens. And in a way, in some level, he's describing a situation which is sort of akin to what the behaviorists say, that we're governed by principles that we don't understand and that we're not really conscious at all. But Gurdjieff differs radically from the behaviorists in the sense that he says that it's possible to develop consciousness, and that if we were properly conscious, that would completely transform the nature of our experience. So Christopher developed these ideas, and at the same time he was trying to apply them to the psychotherapy situation, and he developed a model of what goes on in the psychotherapy interview. And so he had an entire scheme for a taxonomy for describing various activities in verbal interaction in psychotherapy situations, and he related this to Gurdjieff's ideas about consciousness and self-consciousness. And I worked as his research assistant, and we developed this perspective, and I did my master's thesis on the same idea and extended it to other types of interviews. And it was really it's quite an amazing period of time for us, because we were so excited to be discovering these utterly profound and lucid and coherent ideas about the nature of the psychology of consciousness, which really no one in psychology even came close to identifying. And it really challenges the whole kind of assumptive framework on which most of modern psychology is premised. So, it was an extraordinary period of time for a couple of years for us to study this material and to get into it and to realize that there existed this entire esoteric tradition, which we really didn't know anything about. Gurdjieff's teaching was just one of several teachings. And you know, it's kind of odd, because here we were studying to be psychologists, and then we became introduced to these esoteric and mystical teachings, and we realized that this is the real psychology. The stuff that we're being taught is kind of kindergarten psychology compared to this is postgraduate psychology. This is psychology of the highest order. And because it was a psychology which is based on the psychology of consciousness and the nature of consciousness and being, and which challenged the whole idea that you can study psychology by studying others, because all of the esoteric and mystical psychologies are premised on the idea, no, that you don't study others to study psychology, you study yourself, and you study yourself systematically in terms of a discipline. So, as we got into this and tried to learn more and more about esoteric psychologies and mystical psychologies, it became apparent to us that really this was the work of a lifetime, that these ideas were so profound and had such utterly unbelievable implications for virtually every topic in psychology and science, that we realized that, my God, this is knowledge on a scale that we didn't even imagine was possible. And so that was the beginning for the two of us to work on ourselves, through both of us were studying the fourth way, and at the same time to try to develop these ideas intellectually, because that's what we were intellectuals, but at the same time we were always reminded that really the intellectual aspect is only one aspect of it, that you have to study yourself physically and emotionally and intellectually, and that these things all have to be integrated and brought into proper focus to develop a more complete consciousness of oneself. So along the way, after a few years of studying this, Christopher got his PhD from the University of Waterloo. Somehow the University of Waterloo allowed him to do this. And in retrospect, I'm kind of surprised that they did, but he did get his PhD. And he was hired at York University in Toronto, and he began to teach psychology there, and he worked in the Counseling and Development Center too, doing psychotherapy. And so he, rather than turning his attention to murdering rats or duping undergraduates, which are really the primary activities of most academic psychologists, he decided that he was going to pursue his mystical and esoteric interests, and he began to write a book about Gurdjieff and the fourth way. And he was well into his manuscript and was nearly actually finished when he presented me the beginnings of another book at one point that he had started, called The Problem of God's Contracting Universe. And the title of The Problem of God's Contracting Universe is Chris's label for something that he read in Carl Sagan's work. Carl Sagan had published a book in, I think, 1979 called Broca's Brain, Reflections on the Romance of Science, which is a collection of essays that Sagan wrote about various topics in science. Very interesting book. And in one of them, one of the essays is called A Sunday Sermon. And in that sermon, Sagan talks about the advance of science and its relation to the existence of God and the reality of spiritual teachings. And one of the things that the central point that he makes is that as science advances, as we become more and more knowledgeable about the natural processes which explain things, it seems that there's less and less for God to do. For instance, he gives the example of the opening of the morning glory. And he says, it used to be thought that the morning glory opened because God micro-intervened and told the flower to open. But he says, now we know that the morning glory opens because of plant hormones and the activity of the sun. And then it's a response to the sun. And he says it's the same for the entire scheme of causality back to the origins of the universe. There seems to be less and less for God to do as science provides more and more complex and comprehensive natural explanations of things. So Chris's question was, well, is this true? Is it true that as science advances, there's less and less for God to do? And he called this the problem of God's contracting universe. So he decided that he was going to write a reply to Carl Sagan, and he was going to base it on a consideration of the sciences, the pseudosciences, the psychic sciences, so-called, and the ancient esoteric and mystical teachings. And that was 1979, I believe, he first wrote that. And since then, he's written 8 books and on a variety of topics having to do with mystical and esoteric teachings. And he doesn't use the title, The Problem of God's Contracting Universe, anymore, but I would say that if you wanted a label for his entire corpus of work, what Christopher Holmes addresses in his writing is this question: is it true that as science advances, there's less and less for God to do? And of course, his answer is that no, this is utterly ridiculous. That Sagan's whole premise is completely unreasonable and is based on a very distorted and limited understanding of the nature of scientific evidence and the nature of the claims regarding spiritual realities. Sagan and almost all the rational, skeptical debunkers of all things spiritual, such as Richard Dawkins, who I call Son of Sagan, basically provide very limited and incomplete understandings of spiritual teachings and then attack them. So really what they do is they set up these straw men, which are based on very, very limited understandings of spiritual teachings, and they attack them, and then they feel very clever and very satisfied with themselves and conclude that they've proven that there's almost certainly no God. In Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, he has a chapter in which he says why there is almost certainly no God. And I would say that, well, I'm actually writing a reply to Richard Dawkins, and I have a chapter, a subheading, in which I say why Richard Dawkins is almost certainly not as clever as he thinks he is. And really, this question, as I say, is what Christopher's been examining for the last 30 years. And if you go to www.zeropoint.ca, you'll see, I think, a very interesting and comprehensive model. There's just elements of it on the website, but you'll see that he's got material which really challenges this whole idea that somehow scientific advances spell the end of God or are contracting God's domain. Now, what I was getting to with this rather long-winded discussion of the problem of God's contracting universe is that I'm writing a book called The Problem of God's Contracting Universe right now. And I've always really liked that title. It's one of my favorite titles. Chris is very good with titles. I think that's one of his really real great attributes as a writer. He comes up with some terrific titles. I think that's a great title. So I stole it. He's not using it, so I thought I would. And what my book is about is I'm examining this question. I'm examining the works of Carl Sagan and Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and some of the other, Daniel Dennett, some of the other modern thinkers who subscribe to this perspective that scientific advances are doing away with the need for a god or gods. And what I'm doing is in the book is that I'm giving an overview of Christopher Holmes's model of consciousness, the heart doctrine and the zero point teaching, which I haven't really gotten into. And what I'm trying to show is that I'm conducting a skeptical inquiry into the nature of the arguments that Sagan and Dawkins et al. Put forward, and trying to show that really that this is a house of cards. That if you really look closely at what they're saying, it's not just that it's open to criticism from a spiritual, from a mystical and esoteric perspective, but it doesn't even make sense in terms of what science has discovered, because these people are all subscribing to a strictly material viewpoint on the nature of reality. And really, if you look at the history of 20th century physics, even that perspective doesn't really withstand careful scrutiny, because the history of 20th century physics really challenges the idea that a material explanation of things is going to provide a comprehensive account of creation and of human beings. It just isn't so. So that's what I'm working on right now, and I think it's very interesting to examine Christopher's ideas, and I'm just really giving an overview of his ideas because it's much too complex to reduce to one volume the entirety of his arguments. So what I'm doing is I'm trying to provide the broad framework of what his ideas are about the nature of consciousness, and comparing and contrasting that with the materialist position of modern science as represented especially by Carl Sagan, at least in the first volume, and the likes of Richard Dawkins and others. And what I hope to do is, as I say, in the first volume, I hope to provide an overview of this question, and then in subsequent volumes, hopefully, there'll be subsequent volumes, I'll explore specific topics in much more detail. It's an incredibly complex undertaking, and one which at times I feel exhilarated by, and then other times I feel kind of overwhelmed by it, but because it's such a complex set of questions that I'm dealing with. But at the same time, in a way, it's not that complex, because when you get right down to it, as I say, if you really cast a critical eye on the position that Dawkins and Sagan and those of the materialist bent, if you really look at what they're saying carefully in terms of scientific evidence, it just does not hold water. It just cannot withstand careful scrutiny. I see we're coming up to 5 to 5 Eastern Standard Time, and unfortunately today I have other commitments and I can't actually even do the full 2 hours. I'm not sure where Christopher is. I'm not sure what the problem is. I know there have been some problems in the past weeks. Christopher's been touring New Zealand for the last couple of months now, I guess he's been there, speaking to various theosophical lodges in New Zealand, and his work has been very enthusiastically received there, and it's been quite an eye-opening opportunity for him to travel halfway around the world and find that his work is being so well received. I didn't really even touch on this, but lately he's been focusing more and more on trying to extrapolate and comment upon Madame Blavatsky's magnum opus, The Secret Doctrine, and he takes the very profound cosmological ideas that she was articulating and commenting upon in 1888, and compares these ideas with the most recent ideas in modern physics, and it's truly astounding to see how Blavatsky, drawing on the secret teachings of all ages, the whole esoteric and mystical tradition, it's truly astounding to see how these ideas, the most recent ideas in modern physics, she was identifying in 1888, 120 years ago, she was talking about point source singularities, and she was talking about broken symmetries and fundamental cosmological ideas that are now current, and yet she was drawing on ancient sources to put forth these ideas. So Christopher's been very, very interested in the Secret Doctrine. For those of you who've, I don't know if for those of you who have tried to read it, it's a very difficult book to penetrate. Her style is very dense, and it's very hard to kind of understand at times exactly what she's saying. But for the last 20 years, Chris has been studying this, the Secret Doctrine, been studying Blavatsky, and has really gone through a spiral of development, which has been fascinating to watch in terms of understanding what exactly she's saying. And so he has a manuscript now in which he's talking about God, science, and the Secret Doctrine, and that is the basis for his lecture tour in New Zealand. He gave a speech at the Institute of Noetic Sciences in Petaluma, California in the summer, last summer, and through that made connection with various people in the Theosophical movement, and that led to his current tour of New Zealand. And so this has been a very exciting time for him, and it's been very nice to see his work get more and more recognition, and to get this kind of international recognition has really, been terrific. As again, I'll just give one more shout out, Chris. If you are out there, please. If this program is going to continue, you have to come on because I have to leave in about 2 minutes. But yeah, if you can call, that would be good. And if you can't, well, I guess we're going to have to go to recorded music, Don. Trying to see if I can find any further information here on where Mr. Holmes might be. But Dr. Holmes, if you're out there, please call BBS because we need you. And as I said, for those of you who are interested in Chris's website, I'd highly suggest just checking out www.zeropoint.ca, and I think you'll find that there's a wide variety of material there. Chris, the number, I'm going to give it to you one more time, and if you can call on the direct line, is 530-876-3222. And if not, I'm unfortunately not going to be able to continue. As I say, I have a prior commitment this week and can't do the full 2 hours. Just like to take this opportunity to thank BBS. Zero Point is on every second week, every second Saturday from 4 to 6 Eastern Standard Time. And it's been a real pleasure over the past year and a half to have the opportunity to put forth, you know, the ideas that we talk about, that Chris and I have put forth on the program. And it's a wonderful forum. BBS provides a really terrific alternative source of information for people, and we really want to thank Doug and Don for all their efforts, and everybody at BBS for allowing us to be on the air. I'd just like to take the opportunity to wish everybody a happy holiday, and Don, if you're there, I'm gonna have to check out.